From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Australian Malaysian leaders in Perth as search for jet continues. Philippines struggling to account for $600 million in foreign typhoon aid. Indian Hindu nationalist leader not seen as a threat in Pakistan. These stories and more on this Friday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. The Prime Minister of Malaysia, whose government is under criticism for its handling of the investigation into the disappearance of a jetliner on a flight to China, has gone to Australia to speak with the crews involved in the search for the aircraft. Meanwhile, an attack on a Malaysian island resort is likely to further exacerbate the relationship between Beijing and Kuala Lumpur, under strain due to the airliner mystery. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Australia's Prime Minister is trying to manage expectations about the likelihood of finding any trace of a missing Malaysia Airlines passenger jet in remote waters in the southern Indian Ocean. Mr. Tony Abbott spoke alongside his Malaysian counterpart during a visit to an Australian Air Force base where multinational teams are staging a search the Australian leader terms the most difficult in human history.
We cannot be certain of ultimate success in the search for MH370, but we can be certain that we will spare no effort, that we will not rest until we have done everything we humanly can.
Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak told reporters he remains hopeful something will be found.
As I speak, 10 aircrafts and 9 ships are searching the Indian Ocean for any sign of the missing plane. The search area is vast, and the conditions are not easy. But the new refined area of search has given us new hope.
Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared nearly 1 month ago on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The plane was carrying 239 people. Most of the passengers were Chinese nationals. Australia has taken the lead for the search by military personnel from 7 countries. Efforts are now focused on waters about 1,600 kilometers off Australia's northwest coast. Search planes Thursday were flying over a 223,000 square kilometer zone. 2 weeks of scouring the southern Indian Ocean has not yielded any trace of the Boeing 777. The battery of the aircraft's black box is expected to lose power sometime in the coming days. Without that signal, it will become much more challenging to locate any significant part of the plane, now believed to have sunk to the ocean floor. An Australian warship is on the way with an American device that can detect pings from the flight recorders. A British nuclear-powered submarine with advanced underwater search capability and a British survey ship are also now part of the operation. Meanwhile, there is a new irritant for relations between Beijing and Kuala Lumpur, strained over the disappearance of Flight MH370. Authorities say members of the Abu Sayyaf militant group from the Philippines are the suspects in a raid on the Singamata Reef Resort in Sabah State in eastern Malaysia, in which a Chinese national was abducted, kidnapped at gunpoint by 6 men armed with pistols, where a 28-year-old female tourist from Shanghai and a 40-year-old Filipino male receptionist at the dive resort. The gunman fled in a speedboat. Abu Sayyaf is also suspected of killing a Taiwanese tourist who was kidnapped from a resort in the Semporna area last November. Abu Sayyaf has been linked to al-Qaeda, but analysts say a U.S.-assisted military push into Sulu province in the southern part of the Philippines has weakened the group, but it is still believed to have several hundred fighters and holding at least a dozen captives. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
South Korea has acknowledged that a small aircraft, a surveillance drone likely operated by North Korea, flew over the presidential palace in Seoul and took several pictures before it crashed near the border. Seoul says the crudely built unmanned aircraft was equipped with a basic camera containing about 200 aerial photographs, including some taken from directly above the presidential Blue House. South Korean authorities say the drone, which was less than 2 meters long, did not have the capability to transmit the images back to North Korea and was not able to be weaponized. Tensions between the two Koreas have risen in recent weeks because of annual joint U.S.-South Korean military drills and a series of rocket and ballistic missile launches by Pyongyang. That leads us to invite you to take part in our Daybreak Asia poll, which this week asks, should the United States limit its military exercises with South Korea to reduce the tensions between the Koreas? This so far has been a survey where virtually everyone has an opinion. Just 2% say they're not sure. The rest are split closely between the United States reducing the amount of military exercises it conducts with South Korea, keeping the amount the same, or increasing them. You can register your vote and see if you help tip the balance one way or the other at voanews.com/daybreakasia. After Super Typhoon Haiyan struck the Philippines last November, foreign governments and aid groups pledged some $600 million in cash and assistance for the relief and recovery effort. Now the Philippine government says it can only account for some 14.3 million of the donations. Simone Orendain reports that the government is working to create an improved tracking system to find out where the money went.
About 5 months after Typhoon Haiyan pummeled the middle of the country, the government's main website for tracking donations still has many gaps. Right now, the Foreign Aid Transparency Hub website shows pledges to three Philippine government agencies, but there are holes in the data. Presidential spokesman Edwin Lacerda admits that the website does not reflect where exactly the money is going, but he says the government will remedy that situation this month with an updated version that will provide more transparency.
We are not going to only track donations to government, but also how those pledges and assistance have been converted to, and to what channels, or what we call channels or organizations that they're going to be furnished to.
For the new version, the Philippines will require foreign governments to submit detailed information of where their pledges have gone. Authorities say this will help them account for much more of the donated funds. As for tracking what the Philippine government has received directly, Lacerda says those agencies are still putting together reports of where the money was spent. Cleo Kalimbahin is Executive Director of Transparency International Philippines. She commends the government for creating the website, but she says it is not very informative. And even with additional information in the new version, the huge gap between pledges versus cash accepted might not necessarily close.
A lot of private organizations and agencies channeled some of those aid directly to their counterpart, for instance, and that would be very difficult to track. Also difficult to track would be aid that was given directly to local governments, and sometimes that happens because sometimes these local governments have strong relationships with other countries directly.
Ramon Casible says improved transparency about the government's projects for aid and recovery would be better than an improved aid tracking website. He heads the Philippine Institute for Political and Electoral Reform.
The public can look into these plans, the way that they are implemented, and actually give access to the victims themselves if you want to verify the facts or the information. The whole problem so far in the rehabilitation is that the victims are not part of the story.
Casible says some of the bigger aid agencies worry about corruption and so they hesitate to donate directly to governments. Casible points to Oxfam International, which has so far collected $55 million toward typhoon aid, as a model for efficiency in helping the neediest survivors. An Oxfam spokeswoman says all donations collected go toward Haiyan relief and rehabilitation. The money is administered through a management system that follows projects at each step of the process. Another major humanitarian agency, the Tzu Chi Foundation, works directly with the survivors. Philippine Country Chief Alfred Lee says Tzu Chi has so far poured more than $27 million into areas that were hit hardest by Haiyan. He says the money is tracked from start to finish, and Tzu Chi personnel and volunteers are on the ground carrying out the work.
Whatever we spend is handled by us. We never give it to the government and then let the government do the distribution. All our relief activities always done by ourselves.
After 5 months of recovery and reconstruction efforts in Tacloban and other hard-hit areas, there is still a great need for more assistance. Just this week, Australia pledged another $27 million for reconstruction in typhoon-hit areas, on top of the $36 million Canberra pledged in November. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
Our program page at voanews.com/daybreakasia has more on this and many other stories. You can check out my blogs and, while online, follow our correspondents and program hosts, like me, at VOA Stevenson on Twitter and VOA Asia on Facebook. India's main opposition party is expected to emerge as the largest parliamentary force after the general elections, paving the way for its controversial leader Narendra Modi to become the next prime minister. Critics fear the Hindu nationalist leader's possible rise could worsen ties with neighboring Pakistan, but leaders and observers in Islamabad think otherwise. Ayaz Ghul reports from the Pakistani capital.
In Pakistani political circles, the relatively optimistic outlook on Narendra Modi's possible rise to power is rooted in history. Many cite the example of former BJP Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee, who undertook a historic bus journey to Lahore in 1999 to promote peace with Pakistan. That visit laid the foundation for a wide-ranging peace dialogue aimed at normalizing relations and trying to resolve territorial disputes. It led to increased transportation and trade links and a reduction in tensions. The peace process has since suffered repeated setbacks and been stalled for more than a year. Pakistani advisor on foreign policy and national security, Sartaj Aziz, however, admits Modi is unpredictable as compared to Mr. Vajpayee because of his anti-Muslim image and anti-Pakistan rhetoric at times.
The previous breakthrough that we had with India in the Lahore process in February 99, it was also Mr. Vajpayee of BJP. So I think any government that the people of India elect, Pakistan would deal with them. And I think pre-election rhetoric is a different thing. After election, I think the peace constituency in both the countries is strong, and I hope the BJP government, if they come to power, whichever government comes to power, will respond to that.
Indian peace activist Satyapal Arora also dismisses concerns bilateral ties will worsen under a Modi-led BJP government.
The same fear was when NDA government came in power. BJP government will come, it will harden our relation. But history has shown that Vajpayee proved better friend to Pakistan. Because when a person is in opposition, he is free to speak anything. But when he comes in power, in the chair, responsibility, then he behaves differently.
Senator Mushahid Hussain was Pakistan's information minister when Mr. Vajpayee visited the country aboard a bus in 1999. He says Pakistan has changed in the meantime and its parliamentary mainstream no longer uses India to score political points.
The problem lies not in Islamabad, the problem lies in New Delhi. Unfortunately, that in India sometimes a lot of these issues are hostage to domestic elections and domestic electoral politics. In Pakistan, I want to make it very clear, for the last 5 elections, India has not been an election issue in Pakistan. I hope the time comes when Pakistan will cease the election issue in India.
Despite a lack of progress on territorial disputes, trade ties between India and Pakistan have significantly improved in recent years. The development last month brought Islamabad on the verge of granting New Delhi long-awaited trade concessions under Pakistan's international obligations. But Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif withheld the decision at the last moment. Advisor on foreign policy Aziz explains reasons for delaying the decision to grant India trade concessions.
It finalized just less than 1 month before the election. So it was pointed out that Pakistan should not interfere in the Indian elections. So by making a deal with this government, if they get an advantage in the election time, then it will appear to be, some kind of interference. So that's why it was decided that now the election is only less than a month away and the new government will come by 16th of May. So it's better to delay this package.
The Indian election comes at a pivotal time in South Asia as foreign troops prepare to withdraw from Afghanistan. Analysts in Pakistan say close cooperation between New Delhi and Islamabad is vital to prevent their rivalry from igniting a proxy war for influence in Afghanistan. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Located in remote northwestern Cambodia, the ancient Angkor Wat temples have been a wonder from afar for many who have had neither the time nor money to pay a visit. Now, a tour is just a free click away thanks to Google Street View. The company announced the launch of its new ground-level view of the complex Thursday in Siem Reap province, where the temples are located. Senior Google staffer Devon Lan said Thursday the service was the product of more than a year of work.
Yeah. And this is the first, so this really has significance beyond Cambodia. This is a very important part of the history of the world. The site is the biggest religious site in the world.
Yeah.
It's the biggest Hindu temple in the world. So the billion people that believe in Hinduism in the world, this is very important for them. So this is a very important heritage site in a global scale. And since we want to bring the world's information to everybody in the world, this is part of the world's information that we want to bring to everybody in the world.
Google Street View users can now visit 100 temples and sculptures around Angkor Wat via a 360-degree perspective. The new initiative adds to existing virtual tours of the Taj Mahal in India and Mount Fuji in Japan. Cambodia welcomed 4.2 million tourists last year, many of them making that visit to Angkor Wat. We're coming down to the end of our week and maybe thinking about taking in a movie. Coming-of-age stories are popular material for the movies, but every now and then, there's one which tries it a different way. VOA's Ray Kugel tells us about a new film that takes you far away to prove that it can be done.
A story about a young boy overcoming obstacles and family problems is really nothing new. But an Australian movie called The Rocket puts a whole different spin on those ideas. A 10-year-old boy in Laos named Alo seems to bring bad luck to his family. He is the surviving twin at birth and believed to be cursed, according to local tradition, a belief reinforced by his ill-tempered and superstitious grandmother. Life goes on without incident until Alo's family is forced to relocate because of a dam-building project that will flood their village. That's when trouble begins. Alo's mother dies during their move through the countryside to a shanty town after a government promise of a new house, good land, water, and electricity. And more trouble follows. Alo befriends Kia, a 9-year-old girl, and her strange uncle named Purple, both considered village outcasts. Purple is an enigmatic yet charismatic dysfunctional man, obsessed with the American soul singer James Brown, complete with Purple's suit and Brown's hairdo to match. Purple is also a drunk, hooked on rice wine. Alo ignores his father's warning to stay away from them. Through their association, Alo ends up accidentally causing a series of mishaps, including a fire, that eventually lead to their banishment. They hitch a dangerous ride out aboard a bomb disposal truck, cargo left over from massive American bombing raids during the 1970s. The journey takes them to a rocket festival, where Alo is determined to win the prize that would buy them a new home and end all the misfortune that's been blamed on his birth. Alo's rocket entry, literally fueled by Purple's bizarre knowledge of explosives and bat guano, provides a stunning conclusion to their odyssey through the Laotian landscape. The Rocket is Australian writer-director Kim Mordaunt's first feature film after a career in documentaries. I spoke with Mordaunt, based in Sydney, about the two young characters who are the movie's heart and soul, and how his previous work influenced the decision to choose Laos as the setting.
It was one of those things that took the producer and I to that region 10 years ago, and we ended up living in Hanoi and working in Vietnam and traveling a lot to Laos. So it wasn't really, you know, a conscious decision to make a film. It was more about we lived in the region and then came to make a documentary there, which was Bomb Harvest. That really was a reaction to going to the country of Laos and finding out about its history and just going, my God, why don't we know about this country? So really it was sort of a reaction to living and working in that region.
During the filming in Laos and Thailand, was one location more difficult than the other?
I'd say definitely Laos. Thailand's got this really well-oiled film industry. So in terms of bringing on support crew and in terms of getting access to locations, whereas in Laos, because it's still a communist country, there's still censorship, still a lot of red tape, that was very difficult. But we did shoot the Rocket Festival, all that's shot in Laos. All the landscape you see in the film is Laos.
What was it like to cast the film and communicate with your cast?
That's not easy. It took a long time to cast the film. And first of all, the producer and I did a lot of travelling around both Laos and the Laos-speaking area of Thailand. Then we worked with a casting agent. And eventually we found a little girl in a small drama group, sort of puppet drama group, on the outskirts of Vientiane, which is the capital of Laos. Finding her was, I think she just had a very, very strong sense of self. And for him, we'd been looking a very long time. And he waltzed through the door with all that attitude, and he'd been a street kid for a couple of years, so he'd learnt to survive in any way he could. So he was a great little wheeler-dealer, great little talker. Anything he put his hands to, he could sort it out. That aligned really well with the character of Arlo. So, you know, I was working through a translator, but then again, I've also been around the language for a good 10 years now. You're working with play, you're working with imagination, you're working very physically. I'm watching their eyes, I'm watching their body language, and you're trying to find truth on all those levels.
The Rocket Festival is certainly key to the film. Are such rocket festivals common in other Southeast Asian countries?
You've got them in Thailand. But it's the Isan people in Thailand, many of whom are Lao heritage. But in Thailand, it's probably more of a formal event. You know, they're big rockets, but there's often sponsorship. It's a little bit more formal, whereas in Laos, it's still very Wild West. And you get many more rocket festivals in Laos. They happen all around the country at the end of dry season for the calling of the rain.
In addition to the fascinating narrative you put together in the movie, would you say there is really some underlying message?
Thematically, it's about, I guess, first world countries recognizing the impact they have on third world countries, not only in war but in industry. And then on a very personal level, I think the main message is that there's this country with incredible courage. I think the people of Laos are very courageous and very spirited people who have suffered greatly but who are trying to survive. And it is an underdog story, which is something I think we recognize all around the world.
There is much to savor in The Rocket, more than just the unusual location and story. There are great performances from Sitipon Dissima as Alo, the marginalized twin who seeks redemption. Luknam Khaosanam as Kia, the young girl who effectively portrays a sweet fearlessness of her own. And Tip Ponam as the crazy Uncle Purple, whose absurdities are a perfect match for all the indignities surrounding them. Director Kim Mordaunt shows a great eye for telling their story about tradition, pain, and optimism in a world rarely seen. The Rocket is well worth the ride. I'm Ray Kugel.
For those of you online who would like more information about the movie, you can just stop by the website at therocket-movie.com. If you'd like more on the latest world news, all you have to do is stay where you are. Don't touch that dial. Steve Norman's next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs.